Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
We're leaving the Earth, the only home we've ever known, for the farthest reaches of the cosmos.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is known for many things. His update of Carl Sagan's iconic documentary series Cosmos, which aired on Fox earlier this year, being the first planetarium director to demote Pluto from its planet status, and being the first scientist to identify Krypton, the planet of Superman's ancestry.
Please join me in welcoming Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson.
And last night, Tyson strode onto the basketball court at College of the Holy Cross in Worcester to a celebrity's welcome. His day job is leading the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, but he's become a superstar in science circles because he's on a much bigger mission.
I just want to have fun with science literacy. And I want to broaden what people normally think of as science literacy from the memorization of a satchel of science facts to an understanding of how to query nature when there's something about it that you don't understand.
Tyson hates it when the media or Hollywood get the principles of science wrong, and he often steps in to commend or correct the record. He tweeted praise of how physics is depicted in the movie Interstellar, and here's what he has to say about errors in the film Gravity.
Mysteries of gravity. Nearly all satellites orbit Earth west to east, yet all satellite debris portrayed orbited east to west.
Tyson was at Holy Cross as part of an endowed lecture series. He spoke to a crowd of 2,000, most of them college students, about the scientific method, planets, comets, black holes, and more. His goal is to get people to better understand and use science. To get a sense of how much he loves science and learning and experimentation, listen to this exchange he had after the lecture with a blonde-haired, pigtailed girl who came onto center court.
Wait, how old are you first?
Six.
You're six? That is just so... That's awesome. Okay, what's your question?
How can first graders help the Earth?
Oh, help the Earth? Now let me think. All right, let me get down here. Okay.
Tyson actually got down on the floor and sat cross-legged, so he was eye level with that little kid.
When I was in first grade, I was curious about a lot of things. So here's what I want you to do. Have you ever opened the cabinets and pulled out the pots and pans and started banging on them? Isn't that cool? That's fun, right? Yeah. Did your parents stop you? Yeah. So tell them to not stop you next time, okay? because you're just being a kid, and you like to explore things. And your parents don't like it because it gets the pots and pans dirty and because it's noisy. But for you, it's fun, and you're actually doing experiments. What does the wooden spoon sound like on the aluminum pot, or the metal ladle sound like on the steel pot? And they all make different sounds. And it's fun, right? Just tell your parents that they're experiments and you want to become a scientist. And then they won't stop you from doing anything you want. So thank you. Pleased to meet you.
See? Okay. Tyson loves science, and he wants the rest of us to love it as much as he does. I spoke with Neil deGrasse Tyson before his lecture last night. And one of the things I asked about is his recent decision to decline a request to speak at his former elementary school, a public school in the Bronx. He declined, he says, because he became who he is today, not due to his elementary school teachers, but despite them.
I don't think of myself as an explorer in the traditional sense, but I definitely had an energy level that was incommensurate with what the teacher had in mind for how students should behave. So here it is. The teacher's model of an ideal student is a person who is quiet when they're supposed to be, answers questions when asked, and otherwise does exactly what they're told to do. And so there's a certain homogenization of conduct in a learning environment that I don't think fits every student.
I'm gathering that maybe you felt a little squashed or that weren't given the chance to blossom in elementary school, but also clearly that hasn't held you back long term. How do you think you overcame that?
Well, so in elementary school, there was some squashing going on, yes, in the sense of what happens to a flower that's trying to bloom, but it bloomed elsewhere. I bloomed at home. It bloomed at home. By the time I was in middle school, I had, you know, I had my own telescope and I had walk dogs for a living, 50 cents per walk per dog, which accumulates very quickly.
Yeah.
And I bought my telescope and I bought a camera and I had a dark room back when that's how you used to create photographs. I created a dark room in my bathroom, which we had two bathrooms, one without windows. I would convert that when I needed to. I was a very busy kid. I read a lot of math and a lot of physics, but none of this manifested in the classroom because my conduct in school was judged to be not what a good student should be.
The science literacy of Americans in general gets lamented quite a bit. Would you say you feel more optimistic or pessimistic about it?
I'm always pessimistic. But in the world of pessimism that I carry with me daily, I see signs that there's an interest in boosting the science literacy of the nation. Some of these signals are subtle and even comical. For example, the number one scripted show on television in any genre is The Big Bang Theory.
Right.
Though it be filled with caricature, the fact is the sentences that come out of the main character's mouths are scientifically valid. The equations on the whiteboards that surround the labs are accurate and relevant to the theme of the program. They have a PhD physicist advising them. Another show that has played into this is CSI. And its crime scene investigation is now in four incarnations, I think last I counted. And in each one of these, the lead actors are portraying scientists, solving crimes, taking names. Not in a Sherlock Holmesian way, oh, they left footprints in the garden or the door was ajar. No, they are analyzing the science of the crime. And there's anecdotal evidence to show that the number of women who are choosing to major in chemistry in college has gone up over the time that CSI has been a hit show. And the question is whether that will pursue up through PhDs and into the professional as a profession. But they trace it to simply how accessibly portrayed scientists are in these pop culture venues. Cosmos itself, which I had the privilege of hosting, aired on a major network. Fox, the Fox Network, on a Sunday night. Where else are you on a Sunday night? The fact that this is going on in our society today gives me hope.
It's interesting to hear you describe yourself as a pessimist, at least in that one area, because a trademark of yours is just your enthusiasm and excitement and passion for science. So you have this interesting dual role, a little bit pessimistic, but it doesn't seem to tamp down your enthusiasm.
Oh, well, I can be an enthusiastic pessimist. There's no law against that. No, the pessimism is being in a position to highlight where things need to be changed or improved or enlightened, and then find some avenue to enable that, and that's where the optimism comes in. And think about it. You would never need to be an optimist unless there was some force of pessimism operating around you.
Very true. What do you see as the major challenges in science today?
Science in society or science in science?
Science in society.
Yeah, so the question is, does society continue to embrace the moving frontier in the various traditional scientific branches. And I don't see that happening, and so that worries me because innovations in science and technology are the engines of tomorrow's economy. And we've known that, you know, since before the Industrial Revolution. Those countries that invested in STEM innovations have led the world in almost every important measurable way, not the least of which is in security and in their economy and in their health and wealth, both combined. So to the extent that I see people resisting those investments or cherry-picking science in the service of their own political, cultural biases, I fear for the future of the country. We're a capitalist democracy, and the seeds of the growth of capitalism are found in investments in science and technology. Without it, we will fade economically to insignificance on the world stage.
So you worry about there being enough resources to be as strong as we need to be in that area?
Oh, there are always enough resources. It's a matter of whether people allocate them in a way that is wise and has the future stability of our economy in mind.
I've got to ask you before I let you go about this week's comet landing. Is that still exciting to you? Do you still get revved up when you see things like that?
Oh, I get completely revved up if we do anything in space that's never been done before. That's advancing a frontier. By the way, that happened weekly in the 1960s as we went from Mercury to Gemini to Apollo to the moon landing, that you didn't have to go more than a few weeks before there was a new thing done in space that no one had done before. So when people say, oh, people are apathetic about space program, it's because we haven't been doing any. We've been driving around the block, boldly going where hundreds have gone before in low Earth orbit. And now you're going to tell me we're apathetic about space? Do something interesting in space.
Could it also be, though, that people are a bit underwhelmed because technology is so much part of society that it doesn't seem as cool and riveting?
No, we haven't done it. You're not in a position to say that until the first person has put a boot print on Mars, then come back and tell me, oh, we're not interested in that because we'd rather look at their apps on our smartphone. But I claim that if we had people walking around on Mars or moon bases, no one would even care what the robots are doing. Now the robots are all we have, and it's great. It's on a moving frontier, but history has shown there's no substitute when one of our own is sent on a mission. These are the people who we give ticker tape parades to. These are the people we build statues to. These are the people that stories are written about. That is the nature of our culture and our species, to celebrate those who have gone where no one has gone before. And now I'll take it with a robot. I'm good with the robot landing on a comet. I wish NASA was a lead player in this. That's how I grew up. NASA would have a mission and others would say, hey, can we join in? And we'd say, sure. And now this is the European Space Agency.
Yeah.
I tip my hat to them. This is a reminder to we in America that if there's something we don't do, it doesn't mean it'll never get done. Other countries recognize the meaning and value of exploration. And it just means the center of mass of that will shift from our shores to Europe and to the Far East.
Astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City. He's also host of the updated TV series of Carl Sagan's Cosmos and the author of several books. Neil, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, and Kathleen McNerney. We had help this week from Jamie Bologna, Virginia Marshall, and Julia Zabo. And Tim Skog is our indispensable technical director. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back again Monday for more Radio Boston.